Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If this is Tuesday, Europe must still be a mess, and oh, it is. What one economist thinks another will find fault with. And hey, Mayor Bloomberg, what do you want to ban next, man? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 5th of June. We'll have the latest from Europe coming up in just a bit and a conservative take on the economic rut we find ourselves in once again. We begin, though, with food today and a corporate development that a cynic might say is nothing more than a sly marketing ploy, but healthy eating advocates might say is long overdue. Grocery store shelves are packed with products telling you how healthy they are, as you know. Candy bars are gluten-free and potato chips are all natural. It's a little hard to know what to believe. So, as of this morning, enter a certain mouse with big round ears. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, Gregory Warner reports.
The Walt Disney Company made two big announcements this morning. It's banning junk food ads on cartoons and other kids' shows. That starts in 2015. And in just a few months, it will launch the Mickey Check. Yeah, that Mickey. The mouse symbol will be slapped on foods in the grocery aisle that Disney approves as nutritious, only so much sugar and salt and fat. Obesity expert Vicky Rideout says it could provide a single standard that helps parents sort through all those health claims on packages.
You've got one product that says it's the better for you option. It's got a green check mark on it. Another one that says it meets your daily calcium requirements. Another one that says it's vitamin enhanced.
According to an Institute of Medicine study group that Rideout served on, this grocery aisle confusion is literally killing us, leading parents to choose bad foods and driving the obesity epidemic. David Britt is the former CEO of Sesame Street. He says the Mickey label will sway kids' choices. It'll also pay off for Disney.
Every time you can get your logo in front of more parents and more kids, the better off you are.
Jennifer Harris is at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. She says Disney's standards don't go far enough. Breakfast cereals can be up to 33% sugar.
Mickey would allow Honey Nut Cheerios, but he wouldn't allow Cocoa Puff cereal. He wouldn't allow Fruity Pebbles, but he would allow Pebbles, Boulders, chocolate, peanut butter variety.
She says Walmart has stricter standards to earn its Great For You label. But then again, what kid's going to listen to Walmart? In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
If you have a child going to college in the fall, you have our congratulations and condolences all rolled up into one. Congratulations, obviously, for getting them this far. Condolences because, at least on the college part, we kind of know what you've been through. First the applications, then the agonizing wait for the fat envelope or the happy email. Then deciding which school to pick. And then this is where you, humble parent, come in, trying to figure out how you're going to pay for it all. For a lot of families, college financial aid is a trip down the rabbit hole. Forms and formulas and expected contributions and who knows what else. Today, the White House announced a deal with college and university presidents to simplify all that. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, here's Amy Scott.
Andrew Dooley just graduated from Central Michigan University with about $35,000 in student loans. Here's how those loans were described in one of a pile of financial aid letters he got from the school.
It lists an STS-1 federal direct subsidized loan, an STU-1 federal direct unsubsidized loan, and an STUX federal direct unsubsidized loan additional.
And what does STUS mean?
I have no idea.
But at least he knew they were loans. Financial aid expert Mark Kantrowitz of FinAid.org says a lot of schools don't spell out the difference between grants and scholarships, which don't have to be paid back, and loans.
Colleges often use language that describes loans as reducing the college costs. That financial aid package includes loans which have to be repaid. They don't reduce your costs.
Today, 10 private colleges and state university systems agreed to clarify that difference in financial aid offers. They'll also tell students how much they can expect to pay each month on their loans after they graduate. Writer Kim Clark created the website financialaidletter.com to decode the often baffling language of student aid. She says the hope is with clearer information, students and parents will make better choices.
Yeah, I think some parents hopefully will take a step back and say, whoa, no, you know, we can't afford this.
But recent grad Andrew Dooley isn't so sure.
I think at the end of the day, everyone's just going to sign because that's what it takes for most people to go to college now.
And whatever the cost, he says, college is still regarded as the surest ticket to success. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders had a close eye on Europe, but somehow, I guess they liked what they saw. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking a lot about the pattern that seems to be repeating itself again this year in the American economy. Another promising spring, followed by a sluggish early summer. Unemployment has ticked up again. Manufacturing is slowing again. And Europe, well, Europe again. We had Paul Krugman on yesterday about why this is all happening and what we ought to do about it. Today, Stanford University economist John Taylor, formerly with the Bush administration. Professor Taylor, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So as has been remarked upon many times, this is the third year out of three now that the economy isn't necessarily going the place we thought it was going to go. What's happening? What's going on?
It's a steadily weak recovery. It began weak. It has continued weak. People have different guesses, but I think it's largely the policies that have been put in place haven't been the right ones.
It sounds as if you are more worried about what we are doing to ourselves policy-wise than anything that's happening in Europe. I mean, the headlines over there are pretty dire.
They are, but I am. I think this is mainly things that we've done and we could have done better. The recoveries from deep recessions in the past have been much sharper, growth over 8%. We never got above 4% in this recovery. And it's definitely the case that there's dangers from a serious recession in Europe hurting us. But in the meantime, they would hurt us less if this economy were growing much more strongly and unemployment was down.
So if the government's policies aren't working, if the stimulus package 3 years ago didn't work, and if everything that's happened since in Washington isn't working, what would work? What do you think?
Well, I think a policy which is more steady, reliable, more predictable. Fiscal policy has had these temporary reductions in taxes or temporary payments to individuals for their Social Security, all these temporary things, temporary cash for clunkers. We gave people a little bit to buy cars for a month or two. And those, I think, have not had a long-term sustainable effect, if any effect at all. So the alternative really is to lay out a longer-term strategy and get started with it.
But let me ask you this, Professor. I mean, you've worked in Washington. You know political Washington, right? So does any of this temporariness surprise you?
Well, in a way, it does. Let me tell you why. Because we had roughly 25 years without this. We started in the 1980s, got away from the stimulus packages of the 70s, got away from the temporary actions, got away from wage and price setting and controls, and put in more long-term tax reform, welfare reform, monetary policy, which was more steady. So it was quite a difference, and I thought it was working well. So it is a surprise to me we've moved back to this, but you're right. Washington does tend to have to do something sometimes, and sometimes it makes things worse.
So if you were fresh out of graduate school with a brand new economics PhD today in 2012, or if you're a retiree in this country, what do you do? What sense do you make of what's happening in the global economy and here in the States?
Well, I think I would emphasize these policy problems, and that's in a sense an optimistic view, because if policy is causing them, a change in policy can fix them. So for someone who's trained in economics, get in there and try to make it happen, try to get these changes. For someone who's retired, of course, retirees are struggling with these nearly zero interest rates. I would say that's part of the problem we have, articulate those views.
Are you optimistic?
I am.
You are, that this stuff can be fixed.
Because we've had difficult problems in this country before, and we changed things. We addressed those problems. Our democracy responded, and I think that's what I hope will happen now, and we have evidence that it has made these changes in the past, and I think we'll make them in the future.
John Taylor, professor of economics at Stanford University. His most recent book is called First Principles. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You know, it can't be good when the early economic news of the day has the words G7 and emergency meeting in it. Finance ministers from the group of seven countries had a hastily arranged conference call today. Spain was the immediate topic at hand, but rising global concerns about what's happening over there does kind of lend itself to this question.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
To Greece today and John Siropoulos in Athens. John, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So I wonder if maybe this is just me, but it seems with the G7 emergency meeting today and all this talk of Spain being too big to bail out, have people over there gotten a little more uptight about this whole thing the past week or so?
I don't think the G7 meeting makes a very big blip on the radar screen here in Greece, simply because people have been living in a crisis mode for well over a year now. I think it really makes very little difference to the Greeks that the rest of the world is finding other crises to talk about.
Are people there a little bit shell-shocked?
Yeah, people in Greece are going through layer upon layer of shock, and it gets to the point where the shock gives way to numbness, because you see the suffering around you. You see more and more people made jobless. You begin to see people in your neighborhood made homeless. There's a middle-aged lady just down the street from our house, and we're in a middle-aged neighborhood, who's been evicted from her flat, and she has now camped outside the front door to her building with her furniture around her on the pavement and sleeps there at night, and people bring her food. You begin to see this, and it becomes commonplace.
And a little tricky to hear, actually.
Yeah, the unemployment really is where it's at. It's a 21.7% unemployment rate officially, but unofficially it's higher, because if you talk to your friends, you hear about people who haven't been paid for months, but they still nominally have a job. In fact, they're not really employed because they're not earning any money.
John Siropoulos in Athens for us today. You can read more about what he's doing there at his blog. It's thenewathenian.com. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, first trans fats, now big sugary drinks. What do you suppose is next?
I think the mayor should ban emailing after midnight. Late night communiques almost always contain inadvisable emotional content.
Oh, and that never ends well, does it? But first, let's do the numbers. Well, looky there, that is the happy music. Wall Street managed to rise above its nagging worries today. The Dow Industrials ticked up 26 points, not quite a quarter of 1%, 12,127. The NASDAQ advanced 18 points, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 2778. The S&P 500 up 7 points, more than a half percent, came to rest at 1285. Financial shares did pretty well, actually, considering all the recent economic gloom and doom. Citigroup stock charged up almost 4% today. JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America shares both added around 3%. You know how they used to say nobody doesn't like Sara Lee? Well, apparently, that's everybody except the executives at Sara Lee, who just announced a name change for the company. The stock rose around a half percent after the food maker detailed plans to focus more attention on its packaged meat business and change its name from Sara Lee to Hillshire Brands. I, for one, would like to vote no on that. The major European stock markets were conflicted, one might say. The French CAC 40 rose more than 1%. Britain's FTSE stumbled more than 1% today, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its revised productivity and costs report for the first quarter. The Federal Reserve issues its latest beige book summarizing current economic conditions. And don your Manolo Blahniks for this anniversary. The series Sex and the City premiered on June 6, 1998. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Paycheck Fairness Act got stuck in the Senate today, as expected. It would have helped close the pay gap between men and women. That was the argument from the White House and Senate Democrats. Anyway, Republicans say it was just election year legislating gender politics at its most financial. The White House claims women make 77 cents for every dollar that a man does. The other day, the St. Louis Fed figured it's more like 95 cents. We've also seen 82 cents bandied about as the gender pay gap. So Marketplace's Sarah Gardner set out to do a little apples-to-apples comparison.
77, 95, 82. Will the real gender pay gap please stand up? Ariane Higovich at the Institute for Women's Policy Research says she's even seen an older study that put women's pay at 38 cents to a man's dollar. How'd they come up with that depressing number?
It's a longer-term earnings figure over 15 years of time.
Which included women's time out of the workforce to have kids. So where did Obama get his gender gap figure?
The 77-cent figure is based on the annual earnings of everybody who works full-time and has earnings for at least 50 weeks a year.
Which doesn't count lots of women who work full-time hours, but not all year long. If you do that, the wage gap narrows to 82 cents on the dollar. When you factor in for years of experience, career choice, and so forth, it gets closer to that 95% figure the St. Louis Fed favors. So it's easy to cherry-pick the numbers here, depending on your politics. Christina Hoff Summers at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says Obama's numbers don't reflect discrimination, just men and women's choices.
What they study in college, professions they enter, number of hours they work per week. It's different for men and women.
But Ariane Higovich says that's why she thinks Obama's 77-cent figure is fair. It reflects the fact that even in 2012, occupations dominated by women very often pay less. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Okay, here's today's little-known fact about political money. Despite the boatload of cash that's been raised this election cycle from companies and unions and rich people and regular people, did you know both the Democrats and Republicans get tens of millions of taxpayer dollars to throw themselves those big parties called national conventions once every 4 years? I actually didn't know that. There's a move afoot in the Senate, a bipartisan move, we should say, to cut convention public funding. So we asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out what difference that might actually make.
Conventions aren't cheap. They require a whole lot of sparkly bits.
Let's face it, national conventions are now little more than glorified made-for-TV moments.
Terry Madonna is a public affairs professor at Franklin and Marshall College. Consider, he says, last time out's Democratic convention with its dramatic soaring columns.
For what not arguably was one of the most splendiferous conventions in convention history, for effect.
So would a convention without public money go from balloons and streamers and loads of confetti to a more humble affair in a worn hotel conference room with lukewarm coffee and politicians reading from 3x5 cards? It's unlikely. Sheila Krumholtz is executive director at the nonprofit Center for Responsive Politics.
The vast majority of the funding comes from large contributions, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars from major corporations, organizations, and individual donations.
In 2008, $118 million in private money poured into the conventions, far more than the $36 million in taxpayer dollars at issue in the proposed legislation. But cutting those millions could still mean change.
What we could see, which would make a lot of sense, would be much shorter conventions.
Stephen Hess is with the Brookings Institution.
It's reached a point where they bore the people anyway because there's no serious decisions to be made.
I guess there are only so many cocktail parties a person can attend in a week. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Try to wrap your mind around this statistic from the United Nations. Every year, the UN says 65 million more people cram into the world's cities. That's basically the population of France every year. Most of that growth is in developing countries where people are more than willing to trade life in a poor village for life in a poor city slum. The payoff, of course, is the prospect of a job. Christopher Worth has the story from Mumbai, India.
Mumbai is a sprawling metropolis with a population of nearly 19 million. And at its heart is this crowded maze of self-built shacks and workshops known as Dharavi. With around a million people packed into less than 1 square mile, it's one of the largest, most densely populated slums in all of Asia. And Niaz Ahmed is like many of those who move here from small villages in other parts of India.
I came here to find work. I was in school for a while, but when I was 20, I decided to come to the city to make money.
Now, Ahmed earns about $2 a day in Dharavi's thriving leather industry. Crammed into this tiny room at the end of a dark, narrow alley, he's among a half dozen men churning out hundreds of wallets he says are destined for the U.S. and Europe.
I don't know how much they're sold for, but I imagine it's a lot. We start at 9 o'clock in the morning and we finish at 9 at night.
At the end of the day, the men push their tools aside and sleep on the hard workshop floor. Half of Mumbai lives in slums like this, but Dharavi is rare in that it's a hive of economic activity, from a bustling pottery trade to a growing number of tour operators.
So I'll be the tour guide?
For about $10 a head, Ganesh Tinkonkar leads a group of 6 American, Canadian, and British sightseers through Dharavi's noisy recycling districts.
Recycling of plastics, aluminium, cardboards, paint cans.
He says visitors have swarmed through since Dharavi was portrayed in the movie Slumdog Millionaire.
Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
But, Tinkonkar says, the tours try to dispel certain myths about what life is like in the slum.
People always think, oh, there are thieves, there might be guns, there are killings and everything. But we want to show how hard people are working.
It's an economic success story that Lakshmi Iyer of the Harvard Business School has studied closely. She says the slum could be home to anywhere from 5,000 to possibly 10,000 small informal businesses.
The estimates are that Dharavi produces goods worth about $600 million annually.
But many of its industries are also big polluters, and with little in the way of clean water and sanitation, living conditions in the slum are imperfect, to say the least. That's partly why the city plans to redevelop Dharavi with new high-rises. New apartments are to be doled out to some of the residents already here. The others sold off to India's rising upper and middle classes. After all, Iyer says, Mumbai has some of the most expensive real estate in the world, and Dharavi sits on a prime piece of government-owned property.
This land is very valuable. The question is, if you build a 15-story building of very nice apartments, what should be done with these informal businesses?
She says redevelopment could help those businesses grow, but many business owners fear they'll be forced to leave, upending a local economy that thousands of families depend on. In Mumbai, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
That story came to us with help from the International Reporting Project there in Washington, D.C. Does kind of seem like the past week or so everybody's telling you what to eat, doesn't it? Disney today and its new policy on food ads. Last week, of course, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his Big Gulp ban, no big sugary sodas. That got writers at the web magazine Brooklyn wondering what the mayor might want to ban next.
Okay, Nanny Bloomberg, what about banning flip-flops on the subway? That'll go a long way towards reducing exposure to all those unidentified liquids sloshing back and forth on the 2 train.
Or how about the 4 cheese pizza? Who needs more than 2 anyway? The National Institutes of Health says, 2 cheeses, no diseases.
I think the mayor should ban emailing after midnight. Late night communiques almost always contain inadvisable emotional content. Not a good idea.
Why doesn't the mayor ban those mixology classes? One study showed that 9 out of 10 bartending school grads go right on to calling the numbers on those work-at-home flyers.
I'd ban rainbow sprinkles. It's a non-food that's designed to make you eat other bad foods.
Speaking of overeating, why doesn't the mayor ban Spanx? In fact, the mayor should ban all control top underwear. They can lull you into thinking that you're thinner than you are and tempt you to order a four-cheese pizza.
It's definitely time to put an end to those noxious taxicab air fresheners.
And then there's brunch. The mayor should kill that, too. Bottomless mimosas are killing our productivity. Do you know that there's no word in the Chinese language for brunch?
Yeah, there is.
Well, no one in China ever uses it because they're too busy outpacing our productivity.
No. The biggest thing, we need to stop adding apocalypse and Mageddon to everything, as in Snowpocalypse or Taxmageddon. New Yorkers will be underprepared for the actual doomsday scenario predicted for the day before Bloomberg's term expires.
Tim Donnelly, Faye Penn, and Dave Colon there from the web magazine Brooklyn. Share your thoughts with us maybe on what you think ought to be banned. We're on Facebook. Twitter is at Marketplace APM. That's a new one. And you can find me at Kai Rizdo.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that Facebook closed down another 3.8% on this Tuesday. You can now buy yourself a slice of that company for just $25.87, a bit more than $12 off its initial public offering price. I mention that as a way to tell you this. The Nasdaq said today it's going to start explaining how it's going to compensate people for the bungled Facebook IPO tomorrow. Losses to banks and trading firms are estimated at somewhere near $100 million because of that 30-minute glitch at the Facebook Open just a couple of weeks ago. Shares of Nasdaq itself today, by the way, Nasdaq OMX, up 2%, 2.2% to be precise. So there you go. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 26 points, nearly a quarter percent. The Nasdaq up 18 points, 2/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 ticked up 7 points, more than a half a percent. Thanks to Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.